the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Former Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the Senate Intelligence Committee agree. Multiple nations are attempting to influence American voters and U.S. elections. Some states are particularly vulnerable to voting machine hacking. But what about California? We'll find out from Secretary of State Alex Padilla right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up at 11, Film Week and the long-awaited release of Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I can't wait to hear what our critics think about it. Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie star. But first, during Special Counsel Robert Mueller's testimony before two House committees on Wednesday, he issued this warning.
In your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
No, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
Later in the afternoon, Mueller went on to say multiple countries are attempting to influence American voters and affect U.S. elections. Yesterday, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a report largely concluding the same. Well, where do we stand in California? To find out, we ask Secretary of State Alex Padilla to join us. Mr. Padilla, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be back.
So let's start. First of all, these are things I know you're very well aware of, but anything particular in what Mr. Mueller said or the way he said it that picked up your attention perhaps differently?
Honestly, Larry, nothing new from what Special Counsel Mueller said or presented to Congress that was news to me or news to us. What continues to be shocking is the lack of response on behalf of specifically the U.S. Senate and the Trump administration. You know, these warnings are not new. The warnings we hear every couple of weeks, whether it's from Special Counsel Mueller, the Director of National Intelligence, and other intelligence officials. Yet, consider this, Larry, Congress did more in response to hanging chads in Florida from an investment in election standpoint than we've done in response to the threats and efforts on behalf of the Putin administration.
Well, Senate Republicans say that there were previous money that was allocated to allow states to update their election systems that realistically at this point, if they haven't already replaced their electronic systems that don't have a paper trail, they're not going to be able to do it in time for next year's election. So they've described this as being largely sort of a Democratic stunt as opposed to something that would make a real difference. Your response?
Well, that's not entirely true. Yes, Congress appropriated $380 million nationwide last year for upgrades or improvements to election systems and whatnot. But the reality is that was the final butterfly ballot hanging chad money that was approved 17 years ago. That was not new money and certainly never intended to meet our cybersecurity 2020 needs. So we do need new additional and ongoing sustained investments in our elections infrastructure. You know, just a couple of years ago, the Department of Homeland Security designated our elections infrastructure as critical infrastructure, putting it on par with, you know, utilities, our banking networks, communication systems, etc., because it is a matter of national security that we maintain, you know, free and fair elections. But Congress certainly hasn't appropriated accordingly. And I can tell you, as California Secretary of State, and I convene regularly with my colleagues across the country, it is not too late to invest and improve security for the 2020 elections. And it's not just the machines we're talking about. We need to constantly be investing in monitoring equipment, cybersecurity training for staff at a state and at a local level. These are ongoing needs that deserve ongoing support.
In California, has the state allocated the funds for your office to be able to do the kind of training and the kind of monitoring of equipment you're talking about?
Yes, and appreciate you helping me remind your listeners of that. So California's share of the $380 million last year of federal funds is certainly being put to good use, but knowing that is not nearly enough. Both the legislature, Governor Brown previously, and now Governor Newsom more significantly, have collectively approved more than $180 million of state funding for upgrading or replacing voting systems in California, along with that cybersecurity training that I've mentioned. Given those resources on the table, I took the step as secretary to decertify some of the older failing equipment that was still being utilized in California elections. And now every county is on track to have newer voting systems that have been tested and certified to higher security standards in place for the 2020 election. So, you know, taking nothing for granted, but I feel like we're in pretty good shape in California. I just honestly wish that was the case for the rest of the country.
Does that mean, Mr. Padilla, that everywhere in California there will be a paper trail at the polling location, and if any results are called into question, that your office or the county registrar's offices will be able to go back and to physically count those votes?
Yes, there's been some good policies that have benefited California for many years now, including the paper ballot requirement. Everywhere in California, there's a paper ballot and what we refer to as a voter verified paper trail that we use not just for counting, but for recounting if necessary. And in addition, every county is required to conduct a post-election audit after every election. So between the testing and certification of our equipment on the front end, ongoing logic and accuracy testing to make sure it's functioning as intended, paper ballots, post-election audits, and something that's important to remind voters, all of our voting systems are prohibited from being connected to the internet in California, so we make it impossible to systematically hack or rig an election. Taken together, this framework of policies have gone a long way in making California sort of the gold standard for election security in the nation.
We're talking with California Secretary of State Alex Padilla, this in the wake of yesterday's Senate Intelligence Committee report looking at the vulnerability of the U.S. election system, also about efforts of foreign governments to influence American opinions. We're, of course, well acquainted with Russian efforts to do that. The Mueller report, just one of the attempts to quantify and identify that. But, of course, other efforts, individuals acting on behalf of the Chinese government, of the Iranian government, and the North Korean government, these as well. Secretary Padilla, did I miss any countries that we know have operatives attempting to influence?
Look, there's a constantly increasing number of adversaries, foreign and domestic, but especially foreign, that continue their efforts. And frankly, that's due to two individuals. Lack of sufficient response or accountability by Trump against the Russians has sent the signal to others who seek to undermine our democracy that they can go ahead and try, and there will be no consequences. That is a failure of leadership and a dereliction of duty, in my opinion. The other guilty party is Mitch McConnell. There haven't just been Democratic events in, attempts in Congress. There's been bipartisan efforts, specifically in the United States Senate, to invest more in election security, to set higher, better security standards, all of them squashed by Majority Leader McConnell in the Senate. Again, a failure of leadership, dereliction of duty. We have no choice but to constantly be working together and better and invest in our elections. But we'll do what it takes to get through 2020, but we need Congress to get off the dime.
You're laying this at President Trump's feet, but these efforts from Russia began before he was even running for president. This happened during President Obama's term in office. So what is it that realistically a president can and should be expected to do? And how would you see that having a practical effect on Russia or any other government's efforts to intervene?
Yeah, look, just two quick items in response, because we can do a whole another segment, a whole another day on this. Yes, the efforts did begin under the Obama administration. The Obama administration brought it to light. It was in August of 2016, I first got a phone call from the Department of Homeland Security about what they were observing in the election space. It was the final days of the Obama administration when elections infrastructure was designated critical infrastructure. That laid the foundation for the new federal-state partnerships that we're benefiting from today. What the Trump administration can begin with is not just acknowledging what happened in the 2016 cycle, but for the current occupant of the White House to stop undermining our national intelligence community. They are unanimous in their findings, yet Trump continues to acknowledge it, let alone act to hold Putin accountable.
Also wanted to ask you about the voter database in California. We know that the Florida voter database was compromised, was hacked. It's not believed that this changed any results in the election. You mentioned that the voting machines are not internet connected, but the voter database could potentially be accessed on the outside. What security do you have in place to keep that from happening, and alarms that would alert people in your office if it is compromised?
Another great question there. You've done your homework. So an important distinction: we do allow for online voter registration in California. So there's an online functionality there. But that's frankly separate and apart from the actual registration database. And to the extent that the registration tool interfaces with the database, trust me, several layers of security in between, state-of-the-art firewalls, etc., and what is considered a smart best practice from a security standpoint, our registration database is backed up on a daily basis. So should something happen, our worst case scenario is going back to 11:59 the evening before and recreating just a single day's of voter registration activity. We're also bringing a new tool to the voters in California. Anybody who needs to register or update their registration for the first time can do so easily at registertovote.ca.gov. But currently, registered voters can verify their registration status at voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. If any of the information they see there is not up to date or accurate, they can quickly update that or correct it. And the new tool being starting next year, any changes to a voter registration record will trigger an alert to that voter, similar to notifications from your bank or what have you. When you've updated your registration, you'll get a confirmation. If you get such an email that your registration has been updated and that was not you, that's good for you to know. So you can contact your county or our office to rectify it.
Thank you so much, Secretary of State Alex Padilla. We appreciate your talking with us about what's happening in your office in preparation for next year's presidential election. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Alex Padilla, California Secretary of State. Coming up on Air Talk, the end of an era, and that is a change in ownership of the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf. We'll talk about the history of that company, the coffee wars generally at the retail level, and how coffee is evolving as a business. We'll also ask you to weigh in on what makes you loyal to a particular coffee store. Is it the people that work there? Is it simply a matter of convenient location? Are there certain aspects to the stores aesthetically or the types of coffee beans that they offer that make it most attractive? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back with more of Air Talk in just 1 minute. I don't think it's too much to say the history of American coffee consumption was dramatically affected by the 1966 honeymoon of Los Angeles residents Herbert and Mona Hyman. The Hymans owned a company that provided mediocre coffee to offices. But after visiting Sweden on their honeymoon, apparently enjoying the great coffee available to Europeans, the Hymans thought LA was ready for the same experience. They opened their first coffee bean store in Brentwood in 1968. Soon started expanding in Southern California. They sold coffee prepared in ways Angelenos generally hadn't experienced unless they traveled to Europe. The store sold whole beans for home grinding long before you'd find them in the supermarket. And in 1987, an employee brought a blender into the Westwood store and ice blended drinks begun, the precursor to Starbucks Frappuccinos. Despite the coffee bean's historic role in popularizing high-end coffee, the chain had been finding it hard to compete. Its financial woes have led Philippines-based Jollibee Foods Corporation to buy Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf for $350 million. Jollibee shareholders apparently don't think much of the deal, as evidenced by the stock's immediate decline. My question for you is, with this historic move, what attracts you to a particular coffee store? Are you brand loyal? Does the convenience of the location outweigh everything else? What about the aesthetics of the store? What do you find yourself going back because of the staff, and that is really what builds your loyalty? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. With me from Jones Coffee Roasters, the founder and owner of Jones, Chuck Jones. He operates a five-generation coffee farm in Guatemala, as well as Jones Coffee retail establishment just down the street from our KPCC studios. Chuck, good to have you with us again.
Great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I have to admit that I tend to be more loyal with independent operators like yourself than with chains. And I wonder, for your customers, how much do you think that is a factor? They like the fact it's locally owned.
I think it's a huge factor for us. I think that the local angle is our best competitive advantage over the competitors in our market. And I failed miserably when I tried to set up shop in West Hollywood, and that was just too far for the brand loyalty. And then when I buckled down and stayed local, it's paid off.
How do you compete with the Starbucks, the Pete's, the big chains that have, you know, such massive inventory and ordering? How financially do you, as a smaller operator, compete?
I think the consumer is more interested in keeping their money as close as possible to their home communities and neighborhoods. And I think that Trader Joe's is a good example of that. Even though it's a national brand, I think they really focus on the neighborhood, and they're able to make that their competitive advantage.
Also, as you look at Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, you know, growing up here, I'm curious. I mean, they were really the first ones we saw offering coffee in this way.
Yeah, crazy to think about that. I know that Glory Jeans was also a model that was growing about the same time as Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf on the national platform. But Herb Hyman and Bud Benzel, who's another who was one of his original partners here in Pasadena, they had a store, and I grew up with Bud Benzel and his program, and the ice blended program was also an amazing model to follow. When I'm not a big fan of blenders, I think that they're unhealthy and noisy, but the market loves the blenders, and I think that the local angle made a big difference for Coffee Bean in their growth.
We're talking with Chuck Jones, founder and owner of Jones Coffee Roasters. Their coffee store is just down the street on Raymond Avenue from our KPCC studios. And for five generations, his family has operated a coffee farm in Guatemala. And you sell a lot to Starbucks from the farm, right?
Yeah, we do. And Starbucks is a lot of people think that I want to talk poorly about Starbucks, but I'm one of their biggest fans at multiple levels. They changed the way the coffee industry works at the farm gate by setting up standards that focus on the environment and how we manage the land and how we manage the people and the employees and the quality on coffee on top of that. So they've done great things at the farm gate, and even here on the consumer side, they're a great model for treating your employees and providing a great consistent product across the board. And no, I'm not on their payroll.
That's got to surprise people to hear you as an independent speak so highly of a mammoth competitor.
It does surprise people. Yeah, for sure.
All right. 866 893 KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Again, I'd like to hear from you. What is it that makes you go back to a particular coffee store? Is it the particular roast of coffee? Is it the people that work there? The aesthetic, the vibe of the place because you like to hang out and consume your coffee drink on the premises? What is it that makes you loyal? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Vincent in South L.A. says, I'm a tea drinker and Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf has way better tea than Starbucks. I'm concerned the new owners won't maintain the same quality. Also with us, president of J. Gaines Consulting, based in New York, market strategist in the coffee sector, Judy Gaines. Judy, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
What was the biggest challenge Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf had in competing with the other chains?
Well, I'm sitting here in Panama, and they had a number of locations, and some of them had to close. Part of that was the downturn in the economics here in Panama and also increased competition. And a big part of that, as you said, for the customer, the person who they're engaging with is the employee. And I can't stress enough how much that employee interaction and experience with the customer is so vital to building brand loyalty and having someone repeatedly and consistently coming to you despite the increased competition. Maybe they'll try another location, but they're going to come back to you because they want that communication. So if a barista is well-trained, will remember a customer's name, will remember what they like, will remember what they order on a consistent basis, and then even make suggestions and say something as simple as, would you like to try this? I know you always prefer this drink, but let me make something special for you. And I never really saw that in the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf operations that are here in Panama. I can't speak for other locations, but I know that was always a problem here in this country. And so that personalization is vital.
We're talking with Judy Gaines, president of J. Gaines Consulting, market strategist who focuses on the coffee industry. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Doug in Buena Park wants to bring up an Orange County originated coffee chain. Doug, good to have you with us.
Yes, I used to frequent Diedrich's Coffee, and they actually created a roaster that's used by many independent coffee distributors now, although they've gone out of business with their own shops. And the thing that got me focused with Diedrich's was the fact that they truly had light roasted coffee. I actually roast my own coffee now, or I look for small independent distributors because I find it's very difficult to find a truly light roasted coffee, and I think that's probably because most of the chains are creating coffee drinks and people aren't really drinking coffee. If you over roast coffee, it all tastes the same. It's kind of like bread and toast. If you were to over toast rye bread, French bread, it'll all taste the same once it's burnt. But people aren't truly drinking light roasted coffee.
Mm. Doug, it's interesting because I'm a dark roast drinker and I can certainly tell the difference between different dark roasts. So I've heard people refer to dark roast as burnt before. That's not how my palate experience is, but maybe you're talking about even darker roast still. Chuck Jones, you want to respond both on the Diedrich's angle and the intensity of the roast?
Sure. You know, in defense of Diedrich's, Martin Diedrich is still roasting in Orange County at Key and Coffee. He's got a couple of great locations, and he and I stay in close touch all the time, buy coffee together in Guatemala and stuff. And his brother Steven's the one that builds the roasters up in Idaho, and they're great machines. The Diedrich style of roasting tends to have a little less sparkle in it. So it's a little smoother, and then most of the third wave coffee that's out there these days, there's a lot more of the lighter roast third wave coffee that has a lot of sparkle to it. a lot of citric and bordering on sour. So if you don't roast it properly, and what's interesting about both dark and light roasting is you still have to be a good roaster to have it taste good. So you have to be able to properly roast dark in order to have what we call varietal distinction, where you could actually distinguish a Sumatra from a Kenya, from an Ethiopia, from a Brazil. You have to know how to roast it properly versus just running to the dark. You know, and then the light roast is the same way. You need to be able to roast light roast properly so that you don't have that sour, offensive taste that you could get from some of the third wave roasters.
It's kind of sad, though, to see Dietrich's as a local Orange County-based chain go away. It is kind of like the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf. Again, it became a larger chain, but it was locally based. It was L.A.'s own. And it's unfortunate to see some of these go under.
Yeah, I mean, they went under, but you know, the Stumptown was a local brand in Portland, and Intelligentsia was a local brand to Chicago, and those companies have I think been bought out by Pete's. And Pete's and Churn, which was a local brand
out of Berkeley,
yeah. Their second store outside of the Bay Area, their first store outside of the Bay Area was here in Pasadena.
Lake in California.
And that was interesting. The way that they made that move was because they figured out where they had most of their grad students going. And with Caltech in Pasadena, they used that as the demographics to figure out where their first place would be outside the Bay Area. But Pete's was bought by the German company JAB, J-A-B Holding, which is a group that now owns 24% of the world coffee market, which is even larger than Starbucks.
And wow.
JAB also bought Green Mountain Keurig.
Yeah.
So they bought the company, and they bought Dr. Pepper. They've been buying up a bunch of consumer brands as well.
Wow. We're talking with Chuck Jones, founder and owner, and yes, he also roasts at Jones Coffee Roasters in Pasadena, and his family for five generations has operated a coffee farm in Guatemala. They sell to Starbucks as well as supplying Jones Coffee Roasters. Let's see. Robert in Culver City says, my favorite place is Tanner's in Playa del Rey. The vibe is great. The owner, amazing. It's like Cheers to me. Have you ever come across the owner of Tanner's, Chuck?
No, I haven't.
All right. Sean in Hollywood, good to have you with us.
Yeah, hey. So I used to live and work in Seattle in the 90s and the oddies, and I was a barista, and I was a total snob. And I was very picky, and I didn't want to go to chains, and if you went to Starbucks in Seattle, you were gauche, right? You were a tourist. Now, here's the irony. I live in L.A., and I go to Starbucks. Because the baristas are kind. They're nice, I guess, because they get insurance. They don't have to worry about tips. The coffee is consistent. But a lot of the independents I go to in L.A., if I try them out, they're just not friendly. So I really go for the friendliness and the consistency now.
All right, Sean. Very good. So no longer the coffee snob. The people make the difference.
I agree completely. Judy said the same thing, and that's the competitive advantage. I mean, those are the things. Well, the local angle, of course, but also the way the employees are trained and the way that they interact with the customer. You can't really. That's not as scalable as, let's say, your competitive pricing on cups and stuff like that. It's important.
Another diss on dark roast. Dave in Costa Mesa says the dark roast usually covers up poor or inconsistent quality of the coffee. Cheap coffee is dark roasted, like a steak that's well done. You want to respond to that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that you know, when I was talking about varietal distinction at different roast levels, as you go darker, you know, if you start cooking your steak like Donald Trump, then it might be you might not recognize what the steak is or the bread, like the other caller mentioned. And yeah, I would agree that. And I don't know if everybody does that necessarily, because there's a lot of things that can happen after the roasting that could cause the coffee to taste burnt in itself. And that could be stock rotation in the stores, grinding and water temperature could also just make the coffee just taste awful.
All right. Ravi in Studio City, you're on Air Talk.
Oh, hi, Larry. Yes, I love a local industry that's here in North Hollywood on a street called Cleon, which is called Supreme Bean. And they roast all the coffee for Groundworks Coffee. I originally found them maybe over a decade ago. And my favorite blend that they make is called Black Gold. And if you call them up, you can call up the Supreme Bean in North Hollywood, Ask for Lisa.
Hey, Ravi, hold on. No commercials. glad you like the place. All right. Thanks. Thanks very much. Darren in Eagle Rock, understand that you roast your own coffee.
Yes, I've been roasting for 27 years, and I do a dark roast. I've actually been trained by Italians to roast dark. And like your guest there, dark roast is actually really good. I find that people fear it because of it's been over-roasted and cooked too dark and uniform. And really, if you go the opposite direction, it actually can be such a nice coffee with very robust flavors.
All right, Darren. Thanks very much. Chuck Jones, want to thank you for coming in and talking. Just a final word about the sale of Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf.
Well, I mean, we all grew up with it, so it is kind of sad to see that it's been sold. But it's not the first time it's been sold to an international company. The Singapore company bought it about 15, 20 years ago. But in either case, it's got a great history here in Los Angeles.
Chuck Jones, founder, owner, Jones Coffee Roasters in Pasadena. Judy Gaines, J. Gaines Consulting in New York, a market strategist on the coffee business. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up at 11 on Film Week, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the new movie from Quentin Tarantino. When we come back right after our update, we'll talk about some new studies on spaying and neutering very young dogs and whether that has a negative effect on their overall health. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I sure hope you have a nice weekend in store. Something fun, despite the heat, help you relax a little bit. We're going to tell you about movies, including Quentin Tarantino's new film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But first, you know, we hear the advice to spay and neuter our pets, and that's often a term for adopting a dog or cat from an animal shelter, is that the pet first be spayed or neutered to avoid the proliferation of pets that wouldn't be cared for. However, there have been some new studies that look at whether there's a negative health consequence in doing early spaying and neutering. With us from the Morris Animal Foundation, a nonprofit that works to bring research into animal health, the public consciousness, Senior Director of Science and Communications, Kelly Deal. Kelly, thank you for joining us. Kelly, are you there? All right, we will try and get Kelly on the line just as soon as we can. Also with us is Lisa Lange, Senior Vice President of Communications for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. Thank you very much for being with us. Mm-hmm. So some of these studies, which I hope we'll be able to find out about shortly from Kelly Deal, have called into question, you know, what this means for the health, because of the hormonal differences in early spaying and neutering, that it can have a negative effect developmentally. What do you think of that concern?
Yeah, you know, it's so irresponsible to put a study out like this that, you know, it was a very small study. It was on one purebred dog, and it didn't take into consideration, for example, how much exercise dogs get. The number one thing we see with PETA, and I oversee our Let's Fix LA program, which is promoting spaying and neutering in the city of Los Angeles, is that dogs who are overweight are overweight because they're not getting enough exercise. We see over and over, it's just like with people, if you're not taking care of yourself, if you're not eating right, and you're not exercising, and that is the case with dogs, you will see them as they get older. They will get heavier, and that's bad for them. That's bad for their bones. But you also have to recognize that a well-exercised dog is also a well-socialized dog. They need that. They're pack animals. They need it for their physical strength, and they need it to be emotionally satisfied. So, you know, this study is really concerning because what we're dealing with in the Los Angeles area, actually nationwide, of course, is an overpopulation crisis. The biggest problem we have with animals and overpopulation is that we're just not seeing them getting spayed and neutered. And in Los Angeles, it's the law.
Are the older breeds, though, as much a problem as some of the smaller breeds when it comes to overpopulation? Because this study, as I understand it, is specifically about the threat to larger breeds.
Well, this study is specific to golden retrievers. It doesn't even go beyond that. It just talks about golden retrievers. And I think it's always really important, too, when you look at a study, you look at the sponsors of the study. One of the authors of the study is openly affiliated with the AKC, the American Kennel Club. And this is a club, as well as are some of the other sponsors of the Morris Foundation, are pro-breeding organizations, you know, pro-purebred dogs, which we're against. I mean, if someone wants a purebred dog for a reason, they can go to a reputable breed rescue, go to the Pasadena Humane Society that's just down the street here. They have so many purebred dogs up for adoption. But I think it's important to understand that what we see in shelters from here to Los Angeles County, LA, and nationwide is a lot of older dogs. You see a ton of dogs between the age of 2 and the age of 6, which is another reason it's so irresponsible to talk about tell people not to spay or neuter early, because people don't get around to it. If your dog gets out or a babysitter leaves the gate open, a dog can breed in an instant. And for every dog, purebred or not, who's allowed to breed, it takes up a home for an already wonderful homeless animal in a shelter.
We're talking with Lisa Lange, Senior VP of Communications, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. She oversees the Let's Fix LA program for spaying and neutering. As I mentioned before, now with us is Kelly Deal of the Morris Animal Foundation. She is a veterinarian, co-authored the recent study which looks at the concerns about increasing rates of obesity or greater risk of orthopedic injury. For golden retrievers that have been spayed or neutered. Kelly Deal, thank you for being with us. How do you think, based on this study, the advice to spay or neuter should change?
That's a really great question. Thanks for having me on. I think our position is very firmly that we would not say you should not spay or neuter your pet. We recognize the pet overpopulation problem for sure, and spaying and neutering early has really changed that landscape, and that's awesome, and we're very supportive of that. I think what our point was is that in some breeds of dog, the timing might be important to address certain health outcomes down the line. And we wanted to inform a conversation that's already out there, certainly in the veterinary community, about what, is there a timing issue? Is there not a timing issue? Are there health outcomes related to the timing of spay and neuter? And we felt with our Golden Retriever Lifetime Study cohort that we should inform the conversation because we had a somewhat unique data set compared to some of the other studies that are out there.
And is the theory that in spaying or neutering, it changes the hormonal influences within the dog, and that that can have a negative effect on for obesity or for vulnerability of ligaments?
Right. And, you know, actually, our study looks at correlation, and we know that correlation is not causality. There are several studies that look back retrospectively at this question and some conflicting data out there. And we wanted to weigh in with our particular cohort on that question, but the specifics of hormone dose, reproductive dose, on health outcomes, we are just scratching the surface of that now.
So it sounds like it's hard to give real advice as to whether spaying and neutering recommendations or shelter mandates for it should change. It sounds like there's still not enough information to necessarily do that.
Right. And I think they are not necessarily mutually exclusive. I think our study is just another piece of information for veterinarians to have when they counsel owners who come in and they discuss what's best for their pet, right? Which, for example, if you had a large breed dog that's a Great Dane and you see a puppy and you go, well, you know, Great Danes are predisposed to heart disease and bone tumors, and you just need to know that. I think part of the conversation might include well, what time, you know, at what age was your pet spayed or neutered? You know, what breed of dog is it? Is it a mixed breed dog? Okay, fine. Maybe these are potential risk factors based on data that has been published, and you just need to know about it. I'm not sure that with the model of what shelters do and the great job that they do and the real impact they make for folks is whether this means, you know, in a dogmatic way, we have to say you should change your policies. I'm not sure that is the purpose, but maybe it's just making different decisions.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, as a dog owner myself, the little dog we adopted that had been abandoned on our street, we had her spayed young because my concern was like was just expressed by Lisa. You know, what if she got out? Or we try our best to be responsible, but what if she slipped through the gate or something? And we just didn't want to take that risk of that happening. And I guess, you know, this is something pet owners are going to have to consider. If there is a potential downside to delaying, how do you balance that against the risks of, you know, your dog getting out and then you got a whole litter to deal with? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you have questions about this study on spaying and neutering, potentially negative consequences in some older animals. Like to hear from you. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. We're talking about spaying and neutering, mandatory policies generally in effect at shelters for anybody who adopts out of the shelters, and it's widely advised for pet owners to spay and neuter their pets to avoid unwanted animals being produced. However, there's a new study out that takes a look at spaying and neutering in golden retrievers and finds there is a correlation with some negative health effects from it, including propensity toward obesity as well as potential ligament injuries. The question is, that affect an actual decision you'd make about spaying or neutering? Should that be part of the conversation people have with their vets when they take an animal in to be spayed or neutered? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Stephanie, Lake Balboa in the San Fernando Valley, you're on AirTalk.
Hi there. I've rescued animals for 15 years in L.A. I've rescued them off the streets and I pull from shelters. And I just feel like this conversation, you shouldn't even be having it because, especially with a pro-breeding group who did the study that's like so breed-specific, any kind of negative connotation about spaying and neutering your dogs, I feel is just irresponsible. They kill dogs every day, all day long at the shelters, and people need to spay and neuter their dogs. And I try to educate people every day. I'm in fashion. You know, people downtown, I'll stop my car, pull dogs up the street in neighborhoods down there in Vernon where there's...
Stephanie, thanks. I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Dr. Veterinary Medicine Kelly Deal with Morris Animal Foundation, who co-authored this recent study. Your response to the listeners saying, you know, we shouldn't really talk about this, it'll discourage people from spaying or neutering and animals will have to be euthanized as a result.
Oh, well, I appreciate that concern and I want to clarify a couple things that the caller said. First of all, the study is not funded solely by breed groups and it really the majority of funding for the study has come from donors like me and my mom and I'm sure a lot of your listeners. We decided partly to look at purebred dogs because of the genetic component to it. And we had, again, very motivated owners. This particular study is also a cancer study, but I understand her point, which is this going to lead people to be irresponsible pet owners? And contribute to the pet overpopulation program. And we sure hope not. That was not at all our purpose. Our purpose was more to just, you know, scientific discovery is important, and we just wanted to add some information to a conversation that people are already having with their veterinarians and people who are concerned and good pet and dog owners and want to make the best decisions they can for their pets moving forward.
Stacy directs the City of Long Beach's Animal Services. Stacy, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. What point did you want to raise?
Sure. I wanted to just make sure to underscore the importance that it is for people to have a really strong relationship with their veterinarian, because these discussions are really best had with their veterinarian. And having a study, it's great that more studies are being done, and we love that. But having a study with a particular breed of animal when there are hundreds of breeds of dogs, I don't know, gives any of us enough information to make that decision. So yes, definitely talk with your veterinarian. But really, the response of animal shelters, you know, spaying and neutering pets before they go home is because, by and large, most people are not doing that for the animals that end up in the shelter, and they are the direct result of irresponsible pet owners. And we know that people won't spay and neuter their pets after they adopt, which is why so many mandates, including the state of California, have said shelters actually are required to ensure animals are spayed or neutered before they leave their care.
And so you find that if people that you vetted before you allow them to take an animal from a Long Beach shelter, you find that unless you mandate that they're spayed or neutered before they're taken, they're typically not going to do it? The owner won't follow through?
Correct. That's been the historical experience of every shelter across the country, which is why legislation was put in place, you know, over, you know, 20 years ago to start really cracking down on the type of care animals receive in shelters, that it's humane, that shelters are not focused on killing animals, but they're focused on saving them, and that spay and neuter is an important mandate to ensure that animals don't lose their lives in shelters.
I appreciate your call, Stacy. Thanks very much. Let me go back to Lisa Lange of PETA, Senior VP of Communications.
Yeah, you know, we at our Let's Fix LA program, we are literally going door to door. It is the law in Los Angeles that your dog has to be spayed or neutered by the age of 4 months unless you buy an expensive breeding permit. And that was arrived at because veterinarians and experts in the field know that this is not only safe, but the most responsible thing to do. Right now, you can go online and download a voucher for a low-cost spay-neuter, and that's what we need people to do. And we're going door-to-door tomorrow with Los Angeles Councilmember Curran Price in South L.A. to remind people that it is the law that you have to do this. We have an extreme overpopulation crisis. And for a study like this to be put out, it doesn't inform the conversation. It confuses the conversation. We need the responsible veterinarian is going to be talking to people about purebred issues. It's going to be talking to people about, you know, individual issues for their animals, but it's also going to be taking into consideration that this overpopulation crisis is killing animals. The animals who end up in the shelters, they're the lucky ones. We see animals out on the street who are breeding out of control, who are getting hit by cars, who are being hurt by people, and on and on. That's a real problem.
Lisa Lange of PETA with us. Kelly Deal, a doctor of veterinary medicine, co-author of the study. Quick final word from you.
Well, I appreciate the passion and the feelings of your callers and of Lisa, and I share their concern. I just adopted 3 cats from a shelter a month ago, and so I've worked in shelters, and I really am concerned about the welfare of animals, and I think that includes making the best decisions for health outcomes. We want to do the best for these animals, and knowing the risk factors and understanding what the consequences of some of our actions are is important, but it doesn't mean that we don't recognize the pet overpopulation problem. Not at all.
All right. I want to thank you very much for being with us. You're listening to Wear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. A reminder that Film Week is coming up momentarily. Big week in movies. We'll also be joined by one of the cast members of tomorrow night's screening of Boogie Nights Theater at Ace Hotel. Nina Hartley will be joining us as well. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And I hope to see you Saturday night at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, for the screening of Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, the tremendous ensemble cast. One of the members of the cast later with us this hour on Film Week, Nina Hartley, will talk with her. But we sure hope you can join us Saturday night, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Our critics this week are Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and CineGods.com. Also with us, film critic Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com. And co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. We begin with Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie star in the film. Tim, what did you think?
I love this film. And it is a film, by the way. It's digitally projected, but it's a film, shot on film the way Quentin does. In just about every aspect ratio, a lot of 1:3:3, the old television aspect ratio, because a good chunk of it's about these 1950s television series, some 1:85, but mostly it's in 2:39, big widescreen, blowing it up to 70 millimeter in some places. So a movie about Hollywood that's made the way a movie is made. Gotta love it right there. And we wander through this fairly languid story. Quintus has taken his time telling this story that is not about the Sharon Tate killing. It really isn't. Backdrop, this is playing. And he's doing this thing where he re-envisions all this stuff. But we're really just hanging out with these two guys. Brad Pitt being so Pitt. He's just being so pitty, it's insane. And Leonardo DiCaprio having a lot of fun with his character. He's this actor, and Brad Pitt is his stuntman, his double for all this stuff that he has to do. And he's insecure, Leonardo DiCaprio, about his skills and his talent. One of the things that Quentin does in this movie that I like a lot is that the actor that Brad is playing in the movie is actually very, very good. And then he simply dabbles all of this wonderful Hollywood material around for us. Larry, you lifelong, Christy lifelong. Yeah. I arrived in 1990. In 1990, much of Hollywood was still the same as it had been in 1969, which is when the film takes place. So there was still that dirt parking lot behind the Cinerama Dome and all of that kind of stuff. The Vogue Theater sort of out over the front, Musso in front. All of that was still there. So for me, this is just wonderful. I'm looking at this corner chair keeping yucca or whatever it is in Hollywood. I got mugged in that corner. 1994. And so thoroughly enjoying all of that and this sort of Hollywood movie making thing that he's doing. And then we get to the crux of the movie and he pulls the ripcord. And I got to tell you, if you didn't like anything else in the previous 2 hours, the last act of this movie is worth all of the rest of it. When he pulls the ripcord and it goes bananas, it is just so much fun. The theater that I was in, people were just being outrageous. It was just absolutely outrageous. That's how much fun I had with this movie. Now, if you know little neat things, there's a sequence in the movie where Leo goes off to Italy to make these Italian movies, and he's working for this director named Sergio Corbucci. And Sergio is a real director who, of course, created the Django franchise. And they just do all of these beautiful posters. And he's playing with all kinds of fun stuff.
So much
stuff
insider
like that.
Stuff, as he does so well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just right there. And if you know it, it's just all the more fun.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Christy.
See, I'm not sure how I feel about the ending. I'm still working through it. Mm. But I loved everything that came before, because this is every inch a Tarantino film in so many ways, in that it is obsessively authentically detailed to capture the look and the vibe and the costumes of the time. But it's almost like a heightened kind of romanticized vision of that period in time in Los Angeles in film. It's funny, there was so much coverage when Tarantino transformed sections of Hollywood Boulevard and the area around the Cinerama Dome to look as if they did back
in 1969, you don't really see it. Like, you see Brad and Leo driving their car down the street, but it's all just backdrop to immerse you and make you feel like you were truly there. It's every inch a Tarantino film in that it is talky. And it just luxuriates in the language and the obsessive minutiae of the period. But it's warmer. It's warmer and more affectionate than we often see from Tarantino. I think quite often when we think of his films, we think of a great deal of violence. And yes, there is violence scattered throughout. But a lot of it is kind of over the top. In a jokey way, I mean, like in the films that, you know, Leo is making as this actor, Rick Dalton. It's a really affectionate, kind of nostalgic, wistful return to a time that was and a time that could have been.
Yeah.
And it's a period of flux culturally between this idea of an old school kind of Hollywood glamour. You know, you see Leo and Brad hanging out a lot at Musso and Frank's and everything that suggests of that kind of Hollywood. But his time is passing. His time is fading. And this younger, wilder, freer, almost more dangerous vibe in the form of Charles Manson and all his girls, that's coming into LA. That's coming into Hollywood. And you feel that flux and you feel that Leo's character is on the decline, while Sharon Tate, you know, she's on the way up. And there's a wonderful sequence where Margot Robbie goes into a theater in Westwood and watches herself, you know, as Sharon Tate in The Wrecking Crew. And everything flashes across her face as every little sight gag and joke, it really hits with the audience. And she realizes, oh my God, like, this is working. And there's such sweet nostalgia and sadness in that moment of possibility there for her.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot for a long time, but I'm still working through that last act that you thought was fun and exciting.
You mentioned about the warmth, because to me, movie we showed as part of our Film Week screening series, Jackie Brown was loaded with warmth. Mm-hmm. And he can do that very well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm anxious to see how it plays out in this film. You sense the chemistry between the two leads?
Oh, they're tremendous. They are both at the absolute top of their game. And it's such a knowing performance from them both in terms of what their on-screen persona are like. There's a moment where Brad Pitt climbs onto the roof of Leonardo DiCaprio's house and takes his shirt off in the heat to fix the broken TV antenna. And I was like, yes, Brad,
me too.
Do that.
Way to hold it down,
but,
Brad.
But Leo is playing a jokey version of himself too, but also there's such sadness. He has such great range to show here. This might be his best work ever. And then there are, you know, and they have both starred in Tarantino films before, and there are so many little callbacks to other Tarantino films. Like, you've got Rumor Willis, Bruce Willis's daughter in a small part. You've got Maya Hawk, Uma Thurman's daughter, in a small part. They're all these little bitty pieces. So if you love Tarantino, you will love all of that stuff. But that is going to be divisive, I suspect, in a lot of ways as well.
You think?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. I don't know. Maybe my affection is outsized. You know, I know him a little bit. And I look at this movie, affection, absolutely. He loves Sharon Tate. He loves these people, Steve McQueen and Jay Sebring. You can tell that he's thought about these people, that he's considered their lives and what would have been different about Hollywood. You can tell that he loves this city. You know, L.A., Hollywood gets poked a lot in movies. You know, he's not poking at all. For instance, there's no smog in this movie. I'm sorry. 1969, you could not see the mountains from Hollywood Boulevard. I promise you, you probably could not. Yeah, you were here, Larry. You would know, but you couldn't see them in 1990 when I got here.
There was haze to the Hollywood scene. Yeah. Let's put it that way. Once upon a time in Hollywood, Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. It's rated R and in wide release. The Frame took a tour of L.A. with the location scout for the movie, along with the film's production designer. You can hear that tour by visiting our Film Week page. We have a link to it to hear that conversation. A white supremacist falls in love and decides to change his life in the new biographical drama Skin. Jamie Bell and Danielle McDonald star. The film is written and directed by Guy Nativ. Christy?
So Guy Nativ won the Oscar this past year for his live action short, which also was called Skin, which also was about clashes between white supremacists and black activists, which also had to do with the way that how you wear tattoos on the outside is a brash signal of what you feel on the inside, and how those kinds of racist tattoos can really be a great intimidation factor. And Danielle McDonald happens to be in both films. This is not a feature-length version of that short skin. So if you guys saw that and you think, oh, I've seen this story, no, you have not seen this story. But there was already a documentary about this guy, Brian Widener, and it's about how he was a leader in a white supremacist group called the Vinlander Social Club in – here they're in Ohio. In real life, it was in Indiana. And he – does atrocious things. He does awful things. He was lost and destitute and was taken in by the leaders of this group who, you know, you see chillingly prey upon young people like him and make them feel like they're a part of something and then just twist their minds. They're played by Bill Camp and Vera Farmiga, and they're absolutely chilling and horrifying here. But Jamie Bell is this guy who increasingly begins to doubt his beliefs, and he's all in. I mean, he's got massive facial and neck tattoos everywhere that would make it really difficult for him to live any other kind of life. You know, you can't go and sell shoes at Nordstrom with a look like that. And it's about how he meets a woman played by Danielle McDonald. She has three little girls, and he begins to see for himself that a different kind of family life is possible and a different way to thrive and find happiness and fulfillment is possible, and the difficulty of getting out of that life. Jamie Bell's tremendous in this. He's physically transformed himself. He's really, really bulked up here. Unrecognizable, I would say, even. And there's a great deal of tension, a lot of use of handheld camera, a lot of intimate close-ups to feel the struggle of what is going on in this young man's life, and alternates between that and more recent clips of him trying to get the tattoos removed. And those are glossier and more detached and more clinical. So there's a couple of different kinds of looks in this film here, but I liked it.
Very powerful film. If a bit repetitive, in what we are actually seeing happen, the way the way he keeps falling out with these people and this Danielle McDonald and her daughter, and they go back and forth and back and forth. The process of watching the tattoos be removed, which he shoots in these extremely tight close-ups, right? I guess it's a laser that they're using to remove the tattoos. And I have no reason to believe that we weren't actually watching this process, which is apparently extremely painful.
Sure sounds like it.
and he had them all over his face. And every now and again, after we see something horrible that he does, we cut to that. And we see what this person is willing to go through to have this actually removed from his body. I found that extremely engaging, and it kept me sympathetic to his character. I'm not sure that I would have been particularly sympathetic to his character as much as I was over the course of the movie had he not reminded me every now and again how painful this process is and that this guy is actually going to go through. Luke, the fellow who plays Luke Cage,
Mike Coulter.
Mike Coulter,
yeah.
Plays this black activist, and this is what he does. He finds these guys who are seemingly unredeemable, and he figures out a way to redeem them.
Also, there's a scene early on where Bill Camp is addressing all of his followers and talking about Asians and blacks and other minorities using much more offensive language than that, and he suggests, why don't they all just leave?
Yeah.
And the phrasing of that is so chillingly relevant and sadly so that this may seem like, oh, this is a decade ago, but no, this is absolutely now.
The film is Skin, Jamie Bell, Danielle McDonald star, Guy Nativ, the writer-director. It's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. The Macedonian documentary Honeyland is directed by Tamara Kotevska and Ljubomir Stefanov. Christy, what'd you think?
This is one of the best movies of the year. I was completely blown away by it. I, over and over again, while I was watching it, was asking myself, how did they get that shot? How did they achieve that sense of intimacy with these people for so long? It's a documentary about Macedonian beekeepers.
Yeah.
Which does not sound like a very exciting, sexy topic, but it is shot with such love and such warmth and such affection for this woman, Atija, who has been doing a very old-fashioned, methodical way of harvesting bees and honey. She's been doing it forever. She treks across this barren expanses in Macedonia, and she's so good at it and so calm and so sweet-natured, and she sings to them and they never sting her. It's like they know that she means well. And it's her and her elderly mother, who can't even walk or do anything at this point, and this family moves in next door, and they're also farmers, and they're terrible farmers, and they're also greedy. It's like the worst of all worlds. And so it's a very specific cultural look at sort of a larger topic of greed.
Yeah, it's an exquisite film. So beautiful. She's quite the character. You watch this movie, and it's a documentary, but as you watch it, you feel like you're watching a narrative film. Because you ask yourself, could this possibly not be written? But it's not. They shot over the course of all four seasons. That family that moves in next door, nomadic, oh my God, with those little kids, oh my God. That was happenstance. They did not expect that family to move in. They came out of nowhere, and they make the movie.
Wow, Honeyland, the film, Macedonian documentary, the film Unrated at Limley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Coming up, we'll hear about the documentary The Queen, as well as the documentary Mike Wallace is here, back in 1 minute on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We invite you to get your tickets to Saturday night screening of Boogie Nights, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, the film that really put him on the map. Coming out of his smaller feature, Hard Eight, Boogie Nights, with its extraordinary ensemble cast, Julianne Moore, Mark Wahlberg, Burt Reynolds, William H. Macy, so many great actors that are part of that film. And we'll show it Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. I'm joined this week by film critics Christy Lemire and Tim Cogshell. Tim's going to start us off on the documentary The Queen, which is directed by Frank Simon. Tim?
Yeah, this is a fantastic doc. Mostly shot in 1966 or 1967, which is interesting given our Hollywood thing. We're doing this whole little period thing right here. So there was this contest for drag queens that was held in New York, and we watch fly on the wall style as all of these gay men, mostly gay men, arrive in New York and practice and participate in this contest for drag queens. And they are just fantastic. Characters. Talk about characters. They're all characters. They sing, and a lot of it is performance, but then again, that's what they do. They're performing. So, and we see them as they transform themselves into these women to perform in this particular contest. Frank is an interesting guy. The guy that directed this film, he has an association with Roman Polanski. He made a documentary about Roman Polanski's making of his film Macbeth in 1971. Here, he really just let his camera, and again, this is 1966, so he's probably, I'm thinking working with a 16 millimeter, maybe an Aeroflex or something like that, kind of a small camera. He just lets his camera float around the room, the bedrooms and the performance spaces with all of these men. Now, we get to know these men, these ladies, these square queens quite well. They tell us stories, beautiful stories, and every single one of them is just a storyteller. And it's just, you just get captivated and swept up in it. And I just thought it was fascinating and so much fun. 1966-67.
Was the film released back when it was made? Do you know?
I believe so.
Yeah, I believe so.
So this is a re-release.
The 40th anniversary.
50 years later.
50, yes.
Yeah.
I can do math, sure. So it's fun in a kitschy kind of knowing way quite often, because as Tim says, these performers are all just total hams and they're having so much fun. And that's enjoyable, you know, all this time before RuPaul's Drag Race, we have these pioneers here. But what I enjoyed even more than that was just watching them sit around and talk about, you know, being drafted and how they dealt with that and what they said to the draft board, you know, and various social concerns they had about dating or talking to their parents or growing up in the South in a very conservative place and knowing at age 5 that, you know, one gentleman knew he was gay. And so the quiet, intimate truth of the film to me was the most powerful part of all. And then, of course, the clothes and the feather boas and the earrings and all that. That's great, too. And they're all hilarious. But the intimacy of that and the honesty of that really captured me.
I'm curious how close the fashions from The Queen were to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Right? Yeah.
Of course, this is before Paris is Burning. This is before Stonewall, I believe. So you know, watching these men get to be themselves as they can only be when they're with each other completely and totally, that was just a wonderful thing to see.
The Queen, the documentary from 1968, Frank Simon directed. It's at Lemley's Glendale and the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana. It's unrated. The documentary Mike Wallace Is Here is directed by Avi Belkin. It looks at the career of the longtime 60 Minutes newsman.
What you're about to witness is strictly personal. A direct, undiluted, unrehearsed, uncensored interview. My role is that of a reporter.
I'm Mike Wallace.
He was tough as nails, never took orders from anybody.
People didn't ask tough questions back then. You invented that genre.
You're not answering the specific question that I put.
So funny to hear talk about the tough questions because, of course, Mike Wallace also did entertainment television programs, which were totally softball, kind of celebrity sort of puff pieces. Christy, what do you think of Mike Wallace's here?
It's terrific. It's so informative. But yeah, you're right. The commercials and the funny stuff that he did earlier in his career were really the inspiration behind him creating the Mike Wallace persona, quote unquote, that we came to know over 50 plus years in television. He came to CBS News and he felt like he was a lightweight by comparison. And so he overcompensated and acted like he was super tough to gain the respect of people like Walter Cronkite. And that's kind of fascinating because we know him now to be that person. This is a tremendous wealth of archival footage of interviews he did with everybody from like the Ayatollah Khomeini and Vladimir Putin and Malcolm X to Betty Davis and Barbara Streisand and Salvador Dali. And I feel like he's the last of a breed of that kind of interviewer because so often now, not you, of course, Larry, but so often now, interviewers want to be buddies with the celebrities that they're talking to. They want the schmoozy Instagram moment with them. And he just did not care. He did not want to be liked. He wanted to get the answer. He wanted the power of asking that question. And it's so exciting to see, even though he admittedly was not the most pleasant person to work with. One of the earliest questions we see when he's on the receiving end of the interviewing is Morley Safer asks him, why were you such a, and I can't say the word that he says, and he totally acknowledges that he was hard to work with. He acknowledges a lot of personal things that perhaps he didn't earlier on in his career about depression and about his marriages. So I found it really eye-opening.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. There's a device that they use. Most of the interviews, of course, were done during the 1:3 aspect ratio of television, the old aspect ratio. So the interviews are more or less square. So what they do in this film is they do two frames, left and right frames, so that we can see Mike Wallace and whoever he's talking to at the same time, as opposed to what it would have been when we were watching. They would have been cutting between. But we can see them both at the same time very often here. Lovely device that allows us to always be looking at Mike. Mike, I'm glad he was not my father. He was a terrible father. He admits it. So this is not an unvarnished portrait. He was really just a terrible father.
And as people who worked with him will tell you, he was extremely difficult to work with.
He didn't really have a relationship with his son, Chris Wallace, you know, who became president of CBS, ironically, at all. His son was basically raised by another man. They didn't have a relationship until he was about 14, 15 years
old. Chris Wallace at Fox News.
He's in this briefly, and I wish there were more of him. There's a quick moment where the two of them are on set together for an interview, and I wish there was more from Chris Wallace, you know, describing what is it like to be this man's son and to follow in that same path.
Although I kind of understand, I kind of think I know why he's not. I don't think he's particularly crazy about his dad. One of the interviews is with Bill O'Reilly, and Bill. It's funny because Bill O'Reilly calls him a dinosaur, which is just hysterical to me because Mike Wallace, I invented what you do, and you're calling me a dinosaur, and you've taken what I invented and mutated it into this thing that you do that's not what I do at all.
Well, what Mike Wallace was so good at, when he did an interview, he turned it into an event. It wasn't just who he was going to talk to, but the fact Wallace was doing the interview was part of the appeal for viewers. Mike Wallace Is Here, documentary about the legendary CBS newsman. It's at the Landmark Theater in West L.A. John Horn talked with the director of the film, Avi Belkin. We have a link to that conversation on our Film Week page. The French drama At War stars Vincent Lindon. Stéphane Brisé is the director and co-screenwriter. Tim?
Let's see. Shades of Norma Rae, of Martin Ritt, Norma Rae here. This is a movie. We come into this movie, and there is already a struggle between this German company that's going to be shutting down this factory in this small town in this province of France, and the workers are at strike now. They've already given up all sorts of things to this company, but this company simply will. So Vincent is leading this group of workers. Again, shades of Norma Rae, shades of the Dardenne brothers, 2 days, one night, that kind of thing, except for this is an even more piercing film. This film is angry. You can kind of see where that yellow vest movement came from in France in what's going on in this film. These people are angry. The workers, though, are also angry at each other. So there's this infighting thing that's going on, too. Vincent is the man at the center of this. This director, Stefan, made a film called A Measure of a Man, which Vincent was also in about 2015 or so, where he played a blue-collar guy who just became unemployed. I feel like this is a sequel to that film almost. As we follow this guy, there's a moment so intense in this movie that people ought to be forewarned. Forewarned that it's a very, very difficult moment to
because
watch.
Of the violence because in of the
a,
scene,
a particular kind of violence at the be forewarned. Be forewarned.
All right, At War, the French film at Lemley's Royal Theater in West LA. It's unrated. For Sama, a documentary, British U.S. co-production that takes us to Aleppo, Syria. Wad al Khatib is the co-director of it with Edward Watts. Christy?
There are so many excellent documentaries this week, and here is just one more of them. Yeah. This is devastating. This is so hard to watch and so heartbreaking and so inspiring. Wad is a mom, a wife, and a mom, and a filmmaker. And it's hard enough to juggle all of that at once. She's also doing it in the middle of a war zone in Aleppo. And she steadfastly documents the uprising, the anguish, the carnage that she sees around her, all the while, you know, documenting it and surviving it and doing it to preserve it for her daughter. It's for her daughter. And she wants her to know the kind of world that she's growing up in. She wants her to know what can be done to be more hopeful that this is not what life has to be like. And she has the wherewithal and the bravery to keep rolling no matter what. Explosions and bodies coming into the hospital. Her husband's a doctor. He spent a lot of time in the hospital, you know, triaging people who are coming in, and she just keeps rolling. And others, you know, they pass the baby off to each other to make sure that the baby is safe, but she just keeps on going through it all. I don't know how she does it, but we are better for it because we can witness it.
Yeah. When we meet her, she's only 19 years old, very contemporary young lady, off to Aleppo to go to university. And all of this just begins then. It just begins then. So she's there from the beginning. Rolling that camera. We see when she falls in love. When she has that baby. We meet all of these characters, these people in this movie, and, you know, they don't all make it. They don't all make it. And she documents that. And, man, it's just devastating. She is just an extraordinary person.
For Sama, the documentary at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, it's unrated. Let's go back. Rutger Hauer's famous monologue is Roy Batty, one of the final moments of Ridley Scott's classic Blade Runner from 1982.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain.
The Dutch actor Rutger Hauer died earlier this week at the age of 75. Tim, just a quick word on Hauer.
Who I had the pleasure of interviewing way back in the day. The Blow of Heroes was the movie that I talked to him for. Look, we can go all the way back to Turkish Delight and those films. But I got to tell you, Rutger, who was a gigantic man, was a lot of fun. He was one of the funniest people I ever met in my life. Hobo with a Shotgun was only 2011. And he kills it in that movie. He was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie. He's the bad guy in that movie. He's fantastic. And if you want to see him really good, he's in Nighthawks with Billy Dee Williams. He's the bad guy in Nighthawks.
We'll continue on Film Week. One of the cast members of Boogie Nights, Nina Hartley's with us in just a few minutes. The Sound of Boogie Nights, Saturday night, our next Film Week screening, movie set in Los Angeles. Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, our film released in 1997. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Boogie Nights, of course, with a wonderful ensemble cast, including Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, Burt Reynolds, our recent guest on Film Week, John C. Reilly, Don Cheadle, Heather Graham, and William H. Macy. The screening at 7 p.m. We'll have a conversation following. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Remind you, the movie is rated R. This isn't one to bring the kids like The Artist, the last one that we did. We hope you'll join us Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. Also an important part of the ensemble cast is Nina Hartley. She played the porn actress wife of William H. Macy's character in Boogie Nights. She was already a veteran of adult movies and videos, having started in the business in 1984. Nina continues to perform and make personal appearances. She's often the person defending the adult industry on TV and radio talk shows or appearing at major American universities. Nina Hartley, good to have you with us on Film Week.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. It's exciting.
I appreciate it. Well, let's go back to Boogie Nights and start with that. What was that experience like being on the set working for Paul Thomas Anderson?
It was magical. I did not actually, my character was not a performer. She was just someone who had issues. By then I'd been in the business for 15 years and I recognized that, oh, it's like a video shoot, but bigger. Instead of 1 or 2 days, we had 50 days. Instead of a catering table, there were like catering stands. And so it's a scale, multiple production managers, multiple grips, multiple gaffers, as opposed to one guy doing everything. So it was just like being on a video set, but bigger.
Well, and you arrived with the celebrity of working in a subgenre of adult entertainment. So you're known to many people, but it's not mainstream cinema at the same time. So how do you sort of relate to that dual role of being known, but not in the mainstream industry?
Well, this is where my background in feminism, Buddhism, nursing, and women's studies helps me. I recognize that I'm part of a shadow industry. You know, obviously sexuality as it is at once 100% universal and 100% personal, the two sides of the coin. So I know that people know who I am, but because of our culture's attitudes about sexuality, they can't always come out and say, oh my gosh, I loved you in. So they'll sidle up and say, love your work, or are you on TV, or I know you're from somewhere. And I always smile, and I know how they know me. And I'm happy for that, because I couldn't be there in person if I sent the movies, right? There, for me, being in the movies was a Valentine to all the people I would never actually get to meet. So I recognized that no one on the set was rude to me, but only Macy hung out with me because we were doing our parts together. The first day Wahlberg came up with his handler and said hello, and he was completely, you know, polite and professional. Burt Reynolds was very polite and professional, but nobody was personal, and most of them stayed away.
Yeah. So you did feel you were treated somewhat differently?
A little bit, simply because of adult movies. I know I wasn't part of any of the press junkets. Because of my work, no matter how much this person likes me, someone higher up is going, no. And I accept that that's a fact, and I don't take it personally.
Were you consulted during the film sort of about authenticity?
I was. One character, would she be saying, I'm going to go shave or I'm going to use a douche? And I said, in the 70s, nobody was shaving, so that leaves the other.
The film gets back to this pivotal period when you move from filmed productions with a plot. Often people who worked in mainstream mm-hmm. films would moonlight in mm-hmm. adult cinema.
Yes.
And all of a sudden with home video, it becomes, the single camera, shot on video, quick, cheap. And does the film, do you think, get to that sort of pivot point in the industry?
It ends up there. We have to understand that for his research was great. His visuals were impeccable. But he was talking about a period before he was even born. I think he wasn't even born until 1980 or something. And we must always remember that it was a movie about a business made by Hollywood. It makes too big of – I know the character of Wahlberg was supposed to be, on John Holmes, model on John Holmes a little bit with a huge scandal for which Holmes went to jail. But it didn't pay enough attention to the women in the business who really drive the business.
And, of course, the biggest critique that you've been hearing for decades is that it exploits women and that women are objectified as a part of adult entertainment. And this is where you've come out and you've really frequently been the spokesperson for the industry on that.
I have. Commercial media exploits people. And our culture, going back hundreds, if not a thousand years, does seek to contain and control the expression of female sexuality through ownership and, you know, paternalism. So any time a woman is portrayed as overtly sexual, the assumption is she is being forced into it. She does not have agency. So never forget, whatever you see on the movie, it's a movie. It's a movie. And I know what I'm going to do on the set. And if I don't like that kind of scene, I don't let myself be hired. Get the woman who loves that kind of thing. Our culture is so still hidebound around issues of female sexual agency, and that women are still victims of male desire. That's, we still believe sex is something men do to women as opposed to with women, or that women might, God forbid, have desire of their own that might be a little different, and that's hard for people to accept. So for people who say that, you know, pornography objectifies women, advertising objectifies women, Hollywood objectifies women, Hollywood objectifies men, pornography objectifies men. It reduces men to nothing more than a prop, and no one talks about their emotional health or their emotional well-being. So it's a broader conversation to be had. Pornography is easy because we're a puritanical country, and so we get stuck in the representations and not seeing the person behind it.
We're talking with Nina Hartley, who began her career in adult entertainment in 1984, and she continues to work in the business, personal appearances, video entertainment as well, websites. The business has changed dramatically, and we'll talk about that as we continue. But I do wonder, in terms of the respect issue, do you feel like people who work in adult entertainment are treated any differently now than they were in decades past? Because with the internet, of course, it's everywhere.
I think it's a case-by-case situation. Don't forget, the women who choose adult entertainment are adventuresome. They're independent. They are thrill seekers. They are, you know, vital young people who are like, they want this. People forget how fierce adult entertainment performers can be, because we are our independent contractors, but we do have to negotiate our own deals. So, depending on where you go, yes, there's lots of respect. Our fans respect us. My fans are the best people. People who don't like what I do, no, they're not respectful. And if I wanted to cry myself to sleep, I could look at all the horrible things said about me on the internet by all kinds of people, but I don't.
You were at the ability to make a very good living, yes, without doing adult, yes, entertainment. Yes. So one of the critiques is that not all young women or men have that opportunity. You did.
Yes. Anybody who wants to go to school can go to school. Certainly. But why is consensual sex work somehow a worse job choice than fast food? The pay is much better. Many women I know who are mothers love the flexibility in job hours, how much they get per hour. So it leaves them to have time off with their kids. So again, taking into account that individual women are making these choices, I don't like it when the blanket thing, all these poor women, all these terrible men. It's like, I'm a person, an individual person. And some women come to adult entertainment, and it's not the best place for them, and they do need to leave, and most of them do. And it wasn't that pornography did anything wrong to them, but they made a choice that they may later regret, as anybody can. But it's not porn's fault that they made a choice that they later might think secondly about. Super complicated. So yes, I am privileged. I'm a middle class person. I'm a Caucasian. I pass as a femme. So I was able to, you know, leverage my appearance and willingness and my sexual uniqueness I am, you know, an individual person.
That's all right. We're going to take a break. Sexual uniqueness. I like that. Nina Hartley with us, who since 1984 has been working in the adult entertainment industry. She's seen all the changes with technology, in taste that's come along with that. And she was a member of the cast of Boogie Nights, the film we're showing, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night at 7 o'clock. Tickets at KPCC.org/in-person. We'll be back in just 1 minute. listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle, Film Week screening series, movies set in L.A., and our next one, Saturday night, Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. From the cast of Boogie Nights, Nina Hartley joins us, who's been in adult entertainment since 1984. So take us to the set and your experiences on the film. What was the favorite part of working on Boogie Nights?
The favorite part of working on Boogie Nights honestly had to be acting with William H. Macy, who is the world's nicest man. He is a huge talent. He was respectfully treating me like an actual fellow performer. He did not treat me like, oh, some porn chick. So I was completely respected by him as a human, as a woman, as a performer, for which I'm very grateful. He wasn't squeamish. He didn't treat me any differently, I think, than any he would any other performer. The most funny thing, though, was the levels of modesty I had to go through. So at the end of the movie, in the scene where Macy comes in with the gun, they're squibs, you know, so people with the little squib guns hiding behind a piece of furniture, and there you have to time the shooting to the. So it's all very complicated. That scene took like 15 takes, and after each one, I had to put on a robe, go back to makeup, get the squib marks taken off, and come back.
This is to portray the shooting.
So did this fake blood, take it off, and come back. And I had to remind myself, cover up, because on my in I know part of one of the reasons I was hired is that naked is my work uniform, but other people take it as confrontational if I'm walking around nude. So grab a robe. And I realize this is a straight film crew, and they do care, and it does matter, and it's not polite to bring my culture into their culture.
Any funny experiences that happened during the course of making this?
Well, certainly. So in the driveway scene, of course, I am on my back, and the actor is on top of me with people, standing around, looking down. I was in that position for 2.5 hours. Which is not like a regular movie, right? And they had a blanket underneath me, so I wasn't like on the concrete. But still, my right hip was like, hey. The single biggest question I get from everybody, were you really doing it on the driveway? It's like, absolutely, for 2.5 hours. You bet I was. So, of course, all sex in the movie simulated. Of course, it's Hollywood. But people, because I'm not a simulator, normally people have to ask, was it real? It's like, no, it was not real.
Now, P.T. Anderson, he had done Hard Eight, a film I really liked a lot, but not a lot of people saw. Were you prepared for the attention this movie was going to get?
Yes and no. I knew he was an up-and-coming director, so it was going to get a lot of attention. Of course, 70s L.A., you can't beat it. That disco scene was just beautifully shot. I mean, those long tracking shots. I mean, as a filmmaker, I really appreciate his style. I loved his directing style. So he just would come up and say, Trina, try it this way. He was very, very polite and kind in his notes that he gave. And honestly, I have a classic experience. If he had taken out 1 minute of the bad singing and 30 seconds of the face stomping, my entire part could have been included in the director's cut. And it made my character whole. It took me from being a cartoon character to being a more complex character with Macy. It did give a little backstory about why I am the way that I am. And I was sorry that that did not get in even the director's cut. So I was like, it's his art. He gets to cut it however he wants to cut it. It's like, but I know I'm never going to get another chance in a movie. It's like, oh, darn. Oh, heck.
Well, and so your friends, when the movie came out, what was their response to seeing you, not just in a mainstream film, but a big, critically acclaimed mainstream film?
I got a lot of positive attention for it. I remember I got to go to the red carpet, but Heather Graham was the only performer from the movie who would take a picture with me on the red carpet. And I wasn't surprised. I know not to be. Insulted over that, because I recognize that knowing me and how do you know me is hard. It's hard for people to accept, and it's okay.
So their view is that this would be harmful to their careers if they're photographed with you?
Because don't forget, for every person who thinks I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, you saved my marriage, et cetera, et cetera. Other people, I'm a plague bearer, I am a disgrace, and all the other negative things. So I never fault people for the belief system they've inherited from the culture, because I recognize that I really am way out there in left field.
How did you, as a girl growing up in Berkeley, you get your college degree, go into nursing, how did you decide that this was the business for you?
I reckon I didn't have the word then, but I understand that I'm queer. I pass as a straight person, and I've used that to my great financial and personal benefit over time. I can pass through, walls, but through different communities. And we were the same age when Roe v. Wade was decided, and I wasn't even kissing boys at that time, but I understood at the core of my core that without full bodily autonomy, women cannot be equal with men, period, full stop. And that includes my sexual expression and my reproductive choices. If I don't have the right over my own body, I cannot be equal with men. And so I just knew that was really important. If I had been a normie like my sister, I would have just kept voting liberal and have whatever private life I had. But it turns out I am exhibitionistic and I am a voyeuristic person. I'm a bisexual person. I am a, oh, okay. So for me, and I read Dworkin and I read all of those books, and I recognized early on that objectification isn't harmful. It's what humans do. Any animals that mate by sex selection objectify. Why do rams have those horns? Because the lady sheep like it. So I just understand looking is part of what humans do in terms of, do I cross the room and say hello to you or not? So I understood that I wasn't like other people. And stripping was actually the safe place to go, be exhibitionistic, not a bar with drunk people. No, you go to a club where there's rules and boundaries and bouncers. And so it was a completely safe environment.
And that's where you started.
That's
was
where
in
I started,
San Francisco
clubs. And I recognized I really liked sexual performance. And I understood then that men, again, this is the 80s, so men, terrible, bad men, poor women. And the men were just as ignorant of sex as the women were, and just as desperate for information, desperate for a bit of kindness and conversation from a woman who's not going to lead them on. So I recognize as a nurse, part of my job is patient education, role modeling, and advocacy. So I advocate for people's right to be sexually sane, sexually whole, and sexually safe. That's part of my job as a nurse. In our culture, sexuality is sick, and sick people need a nurse's care. Nurses are here to be compassionate, to be kind, to give you space to heal, to treat you nicely, to touch you sweetly so that you can figure out what you need. And sex is such an important part of our individual identity. I want to help reduce sexual shame and sexual stigma and sexual pain and isolation. And I say, you know, I can't be everywhere, so I sent the movies. You know, logistically speaking, I just can't be everywhere.
You're on a mission. I mean, it's very clear. Your work is mission-driven. It's not
just about
personal expression.
Thank you for recognizing that, Larry. It absolutely. I mean, yes, I'm a personal expression, but absolutely a mission. And I wanted to speak also about pornography and sex work from a place of practice, not theory, because in the 80s, all theory. And for the next 30 years, all the academics talked about us, but they wouldn't talk to us. And I'm going to now conferences going, over here, and they're just looking at us like we're invisible. So, you know, my work is not done. But it's been 35 years now, which is just – and you, 35
yeah.
years.
Yeah, it's funny because, yeah, the length of time is in parallel. We're about the same age. And Nina Hartley, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking about your Boogie Nights experience as well as your career overall. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Larry, for having me. Yay, film week.
Nina Hartley, who is one of the important performers in Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson's 1997 classic film, set, of course, in Los Angeles, as are all of our Film Week screening series movies. Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Historic Theater at Ace Hotel downtown. Post-film conversation as well. Get your tickets now, kpecc.org/in-person. I look forward to seeing you at the theater at Ace Hotel. And from all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.